We continue now with The Virtue of Trust by Paul D. Yeager, S.J. The chapter on God's love works unwearyingly. Oh, the greatest of God's love, I shall never understand it as I ought. I've been created by God for God. I am an insignificant soul whom God in His love has created that it may come to love Him, that upon this earth it may be His divine betrothed, that in its earthly exile it may have glimpses of God, that even now it may have a measure of joy in Him in the first place, through the life of spiritual intimacy, and in the second, through the life of union, the while it awaits heaven's eternal union. This is a sublime prospect. This is a prospect well calculated to arouse my enthusiasm, to leave me drunken with love. How often I should ponder upon it, that I may have an increasing conviction of the sublimity of my destiny. If I but come to realize this, however imperfectly, it shall surely not be difficult for me to make my life a life of love for God. In other words, in all the world, to love only Him and to love Him in all the things which are. For God is that infinite before which all things dwindle into nothingness. Though for Him, the infinite, I sacrifice all the paltry trifles of this life, should this be for me a heavy sacrifice? Should it not be a pleasure and an exceeding joy? Grant me, O God, Your light and Your grace. Grant that thus I may have some conception of my divine betrothed, some better conception also of His love. Then every sacrifice, every suffering, every ordeal will seem to me light and sweet, for I shall see it as a mere means to unite me more closely with Him. I too love God with a profound and innate love. As I sadly have to admit, to the unheard of overtures of God, to this unwearied pursuit of my soul by the divine love, I've too often responded only by a strange indifference and a mysterious ingratitude. Of this, the whole of my past life is only too conclusive evidence. What is the reason for this? If I make such poor response to the divine love, can it be that God demands the impossible of me? Can it be that it is incompatible with my nature, insignificant grain of sand as I am, to love Him so infinitely great? Or is it rather that He asks of me something from which my nature shrinks in dread, from which instinctively I turn to flee? Nothing could be further from the truth. On the contrary, He requires me to give rein to this innate love for Him that He has implanted in my secret heart, as in the secret heart of all other men, and that He has quickened in a marvelous fashion by grace. The better to ensure the realization of the plans inspired by His infinite goodness and His loving tenderness on our behalf, in creating us, He has implanted in us an essential and transcendental love for Himself, a secret and intimate love that fills us with trembling ecstasy at His approach, and that before the repeated assaults of His love makes surrender of our soul's citadel. If God, who is infinite perfection, loves us, equally He has created in us a profound and inescapable love for Him, the all-good, the all-blessed, little though we may suspect this. There is no sinner, there is no utterly wicked man, who is not in his secret soul a lover of God. Though he may hate God Himself, no less he loves God's nature. It is in this that the worst misfortune of the sinner lies. He has come to hate Him whom he loves with an innate love. Hell has no greater torment. Damnation has no greater suffering. The damned know an intense hatred of God, of whose hold upon them they are conscious, and whose creatures they know themselves to be. Augustine, that great penitent sinner, has given us his own experience. You have made our heart for Yourself, O Lord, and it cannot have peace until it rests in you. Our soul is conscious of little more than its consuming hunger and thirst for God. Its very essence is its intense craving for God. It can find no definition of itself except as a function of Him. Our eager awareness of being, our yearning to be, unite in one great desire of God, the source of all being, the infinite being. Our will and our cravings for goodness know this same desire of God, the infinitely good. It is this hidden hunger and thirst for God, of which we are normally unconscious, that drives us to seek and, if possible, discover in any and every human happiness a crude image of the God whom we lack. It is this hunger and thirst that are the living secret of all our activities upon this earth. Doubtless we are not necessarily aware of this inherent and transcendental love. We all love God, life's supreme good, yet only too often we are ignorant of this. A burning passion of love possesses us, yet in our unconscious pursuit of God, who is the object of our love, we are forever self-deceived. We imagine ourselves to have found the object of our desires in countless creatures that one after the other seem to offer us happiness and that are no more than a faint reflection, the utterly imperfect image of our beloved. Fascinated and enraptured by a few pale gleams of God that leave these creatures transfigured, in our folly, we surrender our heart to these gifts of God, whose sole purpose is to be the heralds of our royal betrothed, to inspire us with yearning for Him, to make us unwearied in our search after Him. Unfortunately, God has one supreme and dangerous rival that from the first awakening of our reasoning sets out to make our love captive. It is the self, the proud, impure, egoistic self, which perpetually solicits our love and which nourishes in our heart, instead of divine love, disastrous self-love. Unhappily, the years of our childhood and of our adolescence are only too surely the setting of its victory and its success. It seems to increase in us with the years, till the day when the soul starts to devote itself to the interior life, this sorry self succeeds only too well in dominating us and in winning all our love. Little by little, it becomes our God and the center of all our activity. A discovery is to be made in regard to this love. In the recognition of this double truth lies all our interior life. God loves my soul, and my soul is made to love God. Let me seek to make discovery of this holy passion that in an unperceived and hidden manner has been consuming me. Let me learn from experience to recognize my beloved. With the aid of graces, consolation, or ordeals, let me come to love God no longer unconsciously and involuntarily, but with the full consciousness of the soul that has recognized its love's object, and that finding this object ideally lovely and lovable has only one desire, has only one thought, to make surrender of itself, to give itself to God utterly and absolutely by breaking all difficulties, despite the bonds which have shackled it to that repellent lover, the self. Let us examine our past, and we shall see what has been our spiritual life hitherto, what has been God's plan in regard to us. Most certainly, my childhood and my youth have been infected by love of the self. Most certainly, instead of giving all my heart to God from the beginning, I've surrendered it to those countless things that have attracted it. I've surrendered it to that sorry self, forever self-engrossed even in the most holy things, even in the practice of the holiest virtues. Most certainly, I've spent many years in loving this self, in making it the center of the universe, in imagining that all about me was for my own ends, was for the satisfaction, the enjoyment, the glory of this same self. A day came when my soul knew the breath of grace. I perceived how my life, virtuous though it may have been, had been filled with a secret love of the self and straightway I then turned towards God with a more disinterested love. From that day onward, God has directed all his activity to the end of making me realize his ardent love for me and that love's desire for union. His innumerable graces have had this end: to make me intimately understand that he loves me, that he greatly desires my love, my holiness, and my perfect union with himself. At the same time, by spiritual ordeals, disenchantments, consolations, he has given me a clear consciousness of that profound and secret love which, like a God-imprinted seal, is in my soul. He has inspired my heart with trembling joy, giving it delightful consciousness of his presence and of the charms of his infinite lovableness. Equally, he has made me experience the sorrow and the agony of his absence. His varied and manifold activity is directed towards making me aware of himself, that experimentally I may know him to be indeed the infinite, the great, the unique good towards which my soul aspires. Slowly, I have come to understand that all this earth's gifts are vanities, that they can bring my soul no satisfaction, that it is made for greater things. At last, he has revealed himself to me as my treasure and my all. Deus meus et omnia. While the fascination of his love was making its conquest of me, he inspired me with scorn of the self. He has brought me to see the malice and repulsiveness of that rival, of that false lover, whose charms are merely deceptive, whose one appeal is that it is mine own, sorry though it be, and true as it is that I have given my life to it in an almost continual kind of idolatry. Now, each day, he continues to detach me from the self. The alternation of consolations and desolations is a powerful means to this end. At each step of my spiritual life, he emphasizes the vivid contrasts between his enrapturing beauty and the self's hideous repulsiveness. He gives me relish to the sweetness of his infinite perfections. Equally, he allows me to taste the bitterness of the self's false perfections, to the end that I may make better choice between the two rivals which dispute my love. Then the day will come, if it have not already come, in which he will set before me and slowly bring to pass the incredible exchange. Abandon the self, he will say to me. Put away the rags and the sores of your repellent self. Look upon it as a stranger and an enemy. In its stead, I offer you my ineffable perfections. Let them be your own possession, your new self. Love and enjoy them as your own. In them find all your happiness, all your glory. Omnia mei tua sunt. All that is mine is yours. Take courage, O my soul. Be exultant. Let joy enrapture you. I have found the pearl without price, which is worth all this world's treasures. That pearl which is this: the understanding practically that I, this poor and insignificant orphan, this ragged beggar, that I have a royal and divine destiny. I have discovered that heaven's great king loves me with an incomprehensible love, and that he has created me to love him in return. I have come to understand that we are made for one another, that God, the infinitely lovely and the infinitely lovable, in some marvelous way loves the sorry and repellent creature that I am, and that to be more sure of winning my heart, he has instilled in me an instinctive love for himself, an innate and essential predilection, a passion that, though hidden, is ardent and untiring. Now I know that God loves me, and that, though I knew it not, I too have loved him. I know that he works unweariedly to win my heart, to free me from the bonds of my hateful and treacherous lover of former days, and to kill my self-love. Into this he puts all the ardor of his love and all the power of his grace. Open yourself wide, O my soul, to joy and to love, as a flower opens itself to the sun in the spring. Your life is at last made manifest in its true light as infinitely beautiful, magnificent, irradiated with joy. All things smile upon you. No creature could desire a finer lot than yours. You are made for God, reserved to God, branded with God's seal. You are the happy betrothed, coveted of the King of Kings. Open wide your heart to love. Henceforth, this is your life's one need. Love utterly. Love to the limit of love him whom already you love spontaneously, who is irresistible lovableness, compared with whom for you all else has become repellent. A single stray gleam of whom has upon this earth and among its creatures been sufficient to capture your heart. Love and do what you will. From you God asks no more than this. How sweet and easy it is. So only I give free rein to my inclination to love God. So only to the best of my ability I seek him everywhere. No grievous thing will befall me. If God be my treasure, if the whole of my life be a hunger and a thirst for him, a passionate pursuit of my beloved, so only I aspire to him and desire him, God will be content with me, and nothing will hinder his graces that daily grow greater and more marvelous as they lead me to holiness and perfection of union. All things work together for good to those who love God. Many miseries may be mine, many petty betrayals, stupidities and weaknesses. Desolations and spiritual nights may reveal in their nakedness my soul's hideous sores. This matters not at all. His indulgent love will make my beloved blind to all this, or still better, he will make mysterious use of it to increase my self-hatred and my ardent love for him. The lessons trust teaches us. To understand these great truths, to understand them moreover as the result of grace, even a mystical grace, in a vital experimental fashion, to understand them as the result of all our spiritual life and of God's ceaseless working in us, is automatically to love God surpassingly, is henceforth to behold him as the unique lovableness, the only being that our heart is able to love. This, it is not hard to guess, increases tenfold our joyous and unassailable trust in God's love. This is to establish on the firmest foundation our conviction that as a result of God's ceaseless working within us, we shall finally attain to true holiness. God wills my union with him. The omnipotent King desires with an immense desire to unite himself to this poor beggar that I am. It is his will that upon this earth my life shall be lived in love for him, and that in some measure I shall know the delight of perfect union. Moreover, this immense desire, this insatiable need of God, is implanted deep in all the creatures which surround me, and which he has created with this end in view. The whole wide world, the smallest grass blades no less than the firmament's vast suns, all declare to me God's love. From every creature comes the mysterious voice of my beloved saying, "Give me your heart, I desire all your love. I desire to make you one with me, I desire to make you holy." More eloquent than the cry of any created thing, there is the voice of God who is love, incarnate upon earth, that the divine charity may be made visible and palpable to me. For me, too, there is the voice of the cross, with its marvelous preaching of the love of God, which cries to me, "Behold, how I have loved you to the end, to the uttermost end, that I might win your heart and make you holy." For me, likewise, there is the voice of the white host, in which eternal charity is made love's prisoner, and itself ceaselessly asks that on my side I shall return this love. Lastly, for me, there is the voice, plainer yet it may be, of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, cruelly wounded by our indifference, revealing itself to me, surrounded by flames and crying, as once it cried to St. Margaret Mary, "My divine heart is so on fire with love for men, and for you in particular, that unable to contain in itself the flames of its ardent charity, it is compelled to spread them through your agency." After these proofs of love, after these positive protestations of the heart of Jesus, should I not have trust, full to overbrimming, in his omnipotent love? Should I have doubts of his loving wisdom, of his incessant activity to make me holy, of his utter fidelity? Should I trust myself to him only with hesitancy, because in myself I perceive weakness and stupidities committed times without number? The real need, the real cause of all my cowardice and distrust, is the fact that I have never made thorough examination of these magnificent and consoling truths, or rather, if I have made some cursory examination, that they have not grown sufficiently familiar to me. My need is that my whole life shall become slowly impregnated with the fragrance of these faults. By a prolonged meditation at the hour of prayer, by frequent self-reminders during the day's work, I must accustom myself to the thought that I am perpetually wrapped in God who loves me, and who works for my union and for my holiness. In joys and in ordeals, in consolations and in desolations, I must be continually aware of the encouraging truth that all secondary causes are no more than God's instruments to make me holy, that all which befalls me is no more than a means, a disguised and uncomprehended means, it may be, yet a true means made use of by God to purify me, to prepare me for spiritual union, and to bring me nearer to himself. When I behold the entire world as the vast theater in which God and I together play out this great drama that is my life, whose every detail is willed and arranged by my beloved, oh, then I shall have discovered true love, and with it true trust. Then nothing shall have the power to prevent my attainment of the oft-dreamed-of ideal. Yet it is important to bear in mind that in this great drama of our life, which ends with the complete conquest of our soul by God, and with our perfect union with Him in true holiness, usually there are two outstanding acts. In the first, it is God who pursues our soul, and by means after means seeks to reveal to us his immense love. He detaches our soul from all things. By his charms he holds it captive, making revelation of himself as our treasure and our all. Yet, once the soul is in some degree enamored of its beloved, then the second act begins, and it is now for the soul to pursue God. The better to wound it by the shafts of his divine love, from time to time its beloved seems to flee and to hold himself remote from it. St. Augustine says, "You seek, O God, the souls who flee you. You seem to flee those who seek you." For this reason, it often befalls that I have no understanding of God's work in me. The ways of God are infinitely removed from man's ways. He leaves me, possibly for no short time, a prey to desolations and to distaste for spiritual things. He takes away from me my ability to pray. Thereupon, I become nearly incapable of spiritual activity. Yet, this is no more than the effect of his pure love in active pursuit of my perfection. Possibly, he deprives me of a valuable and beloved director at the very juncture when I had the greatest need of him. In the rough path of holiness, he robs me of all guidance, desiring himself to be my sole and sure guide, secret and hidden though he be. He goes to the length of making me feel utterly forlorn. I come to imagine myself alone in the search for my holiness, forsaken by Him, and altogether abandoned on account of all my miseries and all my petty betrayals. Beseechingly, I stretch out my hands to Him. In agony, I repeatedly tell Him of my love, but He makes no response and seems to flee from me. I know every grief known to unhappy love, to love that is forever unrequited by its beloved, so that I come to consider myself the most unfortunate of creatures. When God deals with me in this manner, when, strange to relate, to strengthen my love, He makes me believe that He has no more love for me, and gives me to taste of the bitterness of love's griefs, I must then remind myself that loving me, He longs for me, while His longing is infinitely more loving than mine for Him. It is then that I must remember that God works untiringly to gain all my love, that to kindle my heart He has countless means of which I have no understanding. It is then I must believe in Him and hope against all hope in His faithful love, in that love of which during hours of spiritual intimacy He makes me so delightfully aware. Finally, it is then I must recall His lively protestations of fidelity and the solemn promises to love me forever, which despite my miseries He formerly made, His promises to lead me to holiness. This is the hour for self-surrender, the hour to rest tranquilly, to rest in quiet peace upon the bosom of my God. If dangers fill me with fear, if heights make me giddy, I can do as children do. I can shut my eyes that I may see nothing. I can huddle closer in the arms of God. If I but remain in this assurance and in blind trust within the arms of God, who loves me infinitely more than a mother, nothing can harm me. Nothing can trouble the delightful peace of my soul or lead me from my life of self-abandonment. It would greatly profit us from time to time to recall this valuable parallel drawn by Father Cusson. Our holiness grows rather like those superb tapestries of the finest kind, worked stitch by stitch on the reverse side. The worker engaged upon them sees only the point of his needle, and his successive stitches together make the magnificent figures which are apparent only when every part completed. The pattern is turned to the light, though while the work was actually proceeding, this exquisite beauty was hidden. So indeed it is with our spiritual life and the mysterious work of our holiness, that work which is essentially the work of God, who has outlined its magnificent pattern. We shall not understand it till in heaven God shall indicate that part of the pattern our life has supplied, itself a masterpiece of His love. Upon this earth, we have small perception of it. Indeed, in hours of desolation and spiritual tempest, we have none at all. At such times, the tapestry of our life seems a confused jumble of ill-matched colors. It is at this moment that we need to put from us our poor human reason and to believe in pure and naked faith in the vast and unblemished love of God who loves us. All too many men are then guilty of folly. Instead of keeping their trust wholly intact, at least in their secret soul, they grow agitated, thus counteracting God's action. They struggle like a child who is unwilling to be carried by his mother over the rough parts of the road. So it is with these poor souls whom God would lead to holiness. They make difficult God's hold upon them. They hinder his work and prevent, possibly forever, the fulfillment of his merciful plans. Equally, on the contrary, those souls are happy who, sure of God's love, surrender themselves entirely to him, and with a blind trust, patiently await the return of the divine favors. They allow God to work as his will dictates. They know that in permitting themselves to be carried by him, they make far quicker progress than if they walked with their own childlike steps. Docile and amenable to grace, they help on God's work, and though they be little aware of it, they run in the way which leads to spiritual union. Swiftly they go from virtue to virtue, from stage to stage, until high above the clouds and the storms, they stand upon the summit, which dazzles with its light and love of true holiness. Have trust, take courage, O my soul, be you also among these souls. From this day forth lay in rich store of trust for those grievous hours during which you will have such great need of it. Hold to your belief in the faithful and omnipotent love of your beloved God. Weak though you may show yourself, he will know how to lead you to perfect union with him so long as you do not interpose the one obstacle which he fears, the obstacle of an intractable will or of a wavering trust. So long as you preserve intact the great desire of holiness which he has implanted in you. It cannot be gainsaid that in a drama of love, which is my life, God has a furious opponent in my crafty vanity that seeks to retain my affections. Yet surely this dangerous rival, this sorry self, has already been unmasked. Surely I have at least glimpsed his extreme malice and repulsiveness. Surely I have perceived his yoke to be hateful and oppressive. Surely I have already come to understand that the egoistic and sensual self is my great tyrant, that this vindictive lover makes my state sheer slavery. Surely already I have often stretched out my arms to my true beloved, to the infinite love, that by his very love he may deliver me from these loathsome bonds. Have trust, already the battle is half won. To have recognized my enemy, to hate him, to bemoan the concessions that almost involuntarily I yet make him, this is the beginning of final victory. I must have trust in the infinite love which is on my side and is stronger than I. Towards him stretch out my arms, urgently beseech his aid. This is above all what I must do to hasten my final deliverance. It is surely no difficult thing. O loving God, it is you who shall exalt me to your love's own level. In the main, my holiness is your work, is far more your work than mine. Your pity for my helplessness is infinite as your hate of mine enemy and your own self-love and its diabolic cunning. So only I count upon you, so only I have trust in you and in none but you, how ready you are to help me. Take courage, O my soul, have trust in him who can and will do all to satisfy his immense love and to make you one with him through all eternity. Chapter 21. Trust in Mary. In the first part, we've seen the nature of true trust and the manifold reasons which invite us to practice it. In the present part, we have dealt with the different situations in life in which trust is most necessary to us. It remains for us only to show how great should be our trust in Mary, our Mother in Heaven. Subsequently, we will add in the shape of an appendix a chapter upon the precepts and examples which have been given us so notably by Saint Teresa of the Child Jesus, trust's great saint, to whom these pages are dedicated. Let us realize that Mary is truly our mother. It is not difficult to understand that even generous souls fail always to possess the true trust which they should have in this God, infinitely exalted above us, of whose divine perfections they know so little. It is more difficult to understand how men can fail to possess great trust in God made man, in that sweet Savior Jesus, whose marvelous manifestations of love are within the comprehension of the most spiritually battered souls. The most difficult thing of all is to have a boundless trust in our good mother, Mary, Queen of Heaven. A footnote. In describing the divine love, despite oneself, one is compelled to have recourse to analogies drawn from man's humanity, as the reader will have no difficulty in perceiving the ideas developed in this and the following chapter suggest the comparison of a little child. The expressions and the metaphors used are borrowed from the tender and sensitive love of the child for his mother, and from the relations which this love creates between her and him. In applying these to the supernatural order, they must not be interpreted literally. By making them spiritual, they are to be adapted to those realities that are beyond the senses. If this be not done, the risk is incurred of fostering a sentimental spirituality that, far from exalting us to our Mother in Heaven, leaves us definitely more remote from her in bringing us down to the lower level of the senses. To continue, it is moreover true that no soul, however fervent, has a perfect trust in Mary. If any had, he, petitioning the Blessed Virgin, would obtain all that he wished. In particular, he would petition her for that holiness which is the greatest of their desires. Souls truly holy would be numerous indeed, for Mary would find great joy in according them a grace that she desires more greatly to give than they desire to receive. Whence comes this strange lack of trust in regard to her who is at once our mother and the Queen of Heaven? Do we doubt her power as a queen? Do we doubt her loving goodness as mother? Is it not the right of children to trust themselves utterly to their dear mother? Alas, not herein lies the prime cause of our lack of trust. We have not a childlike trust in her, for the very simple reason that we are not sufficiently her children, that she is not fully our mother, that we have never completely realized that Mary is and must be our mother. The admission should be frankly made. In one sense, Mary is our mother. In another sense, she is not our mother. Objectively, as we often assure ourselves, she is our mother indeed, but subjectively, alas, she is not our mother. The majority of souls, even of those leading the interior life, have always failed to do more than to realize in part this sweet and comforting truth. Mary is our mother. She is my mother. If we realize this fully, could we spend whole days, as is sometimes the case, not merely without addressing one prayer to her, but even without seeking her out and conversing with her? If we realize this as we ought, could we pass years and possibly our whole life and feel no longing for this mother whom we know to be so loving and whom we have never seen? Should we not have irresistible desires to see and to embrace her? How many times have we experienced that deep suffering known to true children of Mary, caused by the thought that we have never seen our beloved mother and never have taken her into our arms? This suffering is known, has many times been known experimentally, on occasion to an intense degree, by those children of Mary par excellence, Aloysius Gonzaga, Stanislaus Kostka, Alphonsus Rodriguez, Alphonsus de Liguori, and nearer to our own time, Gemma Calgani. Their desires were so vehement, their exile's grief so poignant, that they drew down Mary from heaven, compelling her to come to them. Mary, in her loving pity, so greatly desired to solace their grief, and herself knew such urgent need to manifest herself to them upon this earth, that she could not deny herself the immense happiness of revealing to them, once at least, her celestial beauty, of clasping them once at least to her mother's heart. Unhappily, this sorrowful thought of Mary's absence has in all too many cases never touched our spirit. The great grace which Mary alone can give. Upon this earth, We are all like blind and deaf-mute children. By faith, we know that Mary is our mother, that perpetually she wraps us round with her maternal care. Yet we have never gazed upon her radiant beauty. We have never heard the infinite sweetness of her voice. We have never known the soft delight of her maternal caresses. Our days go by, yet, strange as it seems, not once possibly does that fact make us either sigh or weep. We've never known either homesickness for heaven or any ardent desire, any irresistible urge at last to seek out our mother and embrace her for the first time. Imagine a poor orphan, learning suddenly that his mother was still alive, that she whom he had mourned so long as dead was merely lost, and that in a short while he would be in her arms. Would he not know such eagerness that by night he would not sleep and by day he would pine with the fever of his joy at the thought of once more seeing his beloved mother? Yet not once in our lives, it may be, have our cruel separation and our long exile caused us suffering. If this be the case, it is a sure sign that we are not wholly her children, that we do not live our lives as her true sons and daughters, knowing filial feeling for her, that at last and in brief to us, she is not truly a mother, our mother. Let us continue with the virtue of trust on side B.